make it paper. Welcome to episode 111 of Paper Talk, a series of podcast interviews featuring artists and professionals who are working in the fields of hand paper making and paper art. I'm Helen Hebert, and I run Helen Hebert Studio, a hand paper making studio in Colorado's Rocky Mountains, where I create artist books and installations. I also host the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat and papermaking masterclasses here in the studio, and I run a membership program called The Paper Year and teach online classes about paper, light, and books, too. Find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. You can also find the show notes for this episode at HelenHebertStudio.com/podcast. Today, I'm talking with Jenny Frederick, who earned her BFA from the Kansas City Art Institute in Fibers, followed by an MFA from Indiana State University. She apprenticed with Douglas Morse Howell, Bob Serpa from Imago, and received her MFA for apprenticing at Twin Rocker Handmade Paper. Frederick founded Kansas City Paperworks, Inc. in 1983 and has taught at the Kansas City Art Institute and MCC Maplewoods, where she developed a fiber and papermaking program. She is currently a full-time artist living in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and her current work utilizes techniques and processes that she developed following documentation in the Mexican villages of San Pablito in Puebla State and La Canja and Naha in Chiapas. Enjoy our conversation. Jenny Frederick, welcome to Paper Talk.
Thank you, Helen. I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. So let's start out just saying where you're living right now.
I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm in an artist community, El Dorado. It's about 20 minutes from Santa Fe. My studio's in my house now, so I just love it.
Yeah, that's a wonderful community. I know several. There's several paper artists there.
There are, wonderful.
Yeah. Okay. Well, tell me just a little bit about growing up and any childhood influences that made you become an artist.
Okay. Well, I'm going to start by telling everyone that I lost my mother when I was 2 years old. She died of a cerebral hemorrhage. And I was so fortunate that my grandparents adopted me. My father was in the service abroad, and he pretty much gave me up and put me into their hands, which was the best thing he could have ever done.
Wow.
My grandmother, I called her mom. She was my mom my whole life. She was the only mom I knew. Both of them worked for a garment company, Nellie Don, owned by a female. She started this business on her own. Nell Reed, she was married to a senator, and she called it Nellie Don. And so I was exposed to fabric my whole life.
And this was in Kansas City.
This was in Kansas City. This is where I was born and raised. Mm-hmm. And she'd have me go up in the attic and pick out fabric, you know, so she could make an outfit for my date for New Year's and all that. And then my great grandparents had a farm in the country, and I helped a neighbor bale hay, and I used to build little huts out of straw. So I just loved fibers, you know, my whole life.
Right.
And then a huge influence, my uncle, my great uncle, was the editorial cartoonist for the Kansas City newspaper, the Kansas City Star. And he had to make one cartoon a day. So he worked for them for 44 years.
Wow.
And they had a little log cabin that they built that was hewn from walnut logs from the land. And that's my dog, by the way. If you can hear her, she's out. I have a new puppy. And
yeah.
She's in the hall and she's not happy. I'm sorry. He showed me how to make ink out of walnuts. He also did watercolor. And he was a big influence because he showed me that you could make a living making art.
Yeah.
So that was wonderful. He really meant a lot to me. And we ended up inheriting their estate when he died, when she died, actually. And that's where I ended up building a studio years later.
Okay. And you have beautiful images of that studio on your website. Yeah. Okay. And what about in school? Did you
in
do
school,
any?
I had great a great sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Craig. She wore all this New Mexico jewelry and red lipstick, and she loved my work, and she put it up. And so that was really my incentive to keep doing it. And, you know, because my mom died so young, I was an only child, and making art was a way to entertain myself. And my grandparents really supported that. They would buy me, learn how to draw with John Nagy kits and all these art supplies. And they taught me I could be anything I wanted to be, which is great. You know, I had her mom said, oh, you'll never be an artist. And no, they really supported that. And, you know, they knew my uncle made a living making art.
Right, right.
So, and then high school, I had two fabulous art teachers. I took all the art classes I could and got straight A's. And then I graduated from high school when I was 17 because I started kindergarten at 4. And I went to Baker University in Baldwin, Kansas for 2 years. I had a fabulous painting teacher. He taught me about cool and warm light. And Mr. Tom Russell, he was wonderful. And then I ended up transferring to the Art Institute. And I transferred there just so I could work with Joan Livingston. Joan is a felt maker, and she had just come out of Cranbrook, and she was an excellent teacher. And I ended up being her studio assistant.
Oh, wow.
So I learned weaving, I learned felt making. She taught me paper making. She taught us paper making, reconstituting construction paper in a kitchen blender.
Right. And this was in the 70s?
This was, I transferred there. By the time I transferred there, I had all my academics out of the way, and I just did basically 2 years of studio. It was like graduate school. It was wonderful. I got straight A's there, too. I graduated second in my class, I'm proud to say. You know, I really wanted to learn how to do papermaking right. I thought if I ever decide to teach, I don't want to pretend to be a teacher unless I know how to, what I'm doing. So I started pursuing people. That's when, you know, we were in the middle of this paper revolution, this renaissance of fine crafts, really, everywhere, and fine book art. Everywhere.
Right.
So I think I saw in Craft Magazine, which is now American Craft, an article about Douglas Howell. And I contacted him. That's back when we had to type letters on a typewriter. And so we had this correspondence back and forth. I contacted Garner Tullis. He said, just go read books.
That's what we did in those days, right?
It was a rough road.
That's hard to learn something.
Someone. Well, it's all about the shake, you know?
Yeah, right.
So I contacted Bob Serfoot and Mago. Donald Farnsworth had left by then and started Magnolia. So this was 78.
Tell me about Imago. I'm not really aware of that.
Bob Serpa was partners with Donald Farnsworth.
Yeah.
And they were located in Oakland.
Okay. And they were making paper?
Paper. Yes. So I moved to Berkeley. I studied bookbinding at Capricornus School of Bookbinding with a European couple, Theo and Ann Collett. He was from Germany and she's from England. And it was near the university. And then I drove over to Oakland to work with Bob Serpa. He was very secretive. I never saw his beater. He wouldn't let me near it. I never saw his drying system. I never made paper. I cooched. I cooched all day, every day,
wow.
Transferring the paper that he made onto felts.
So
I became a damn good coocher, but I still didn't know how to make a good sheet of paper.
Oh, my gosh.
So I met Kathy and Howard Clark at a papermaking conference in around 78 in St. Louis that Tom Lang at Webster College, he had his paper conference, and I told them my frustration in trying to find someone good to work with and told them my stories. And I ordered a Hollander beater and 20-ton press. I heard your interview with Margaret Rain yesterday, and you were talking. She was saying, well, how many did he make? Well, he made 20.
Okay.
That's an answer for her.
Uh-huh.
You have early ones. I have number 19. It has my name on it. This press is made by Howard Clark for Jenny Frederick in 1979, number 19.
Okay. Yeah, mine was made for Margaret Prentice. And then, so
oh, that's
it's
right.
Secondhand for me. That's why
right.
I have
that's
an
right.
earlier number because it's
from
secondhand.
Peggy,
yeah.
From
yeah.
Peggy. Well, she got one of the first ones for sure.
Yeah.
So they had an opening.
Okay, wait. So where were you? Were you still in California when you met them?
I was in California.
Yeah.
And they made arrangements. They had a friend, David Erickson, in Terre Haute at the university, who had worked with Lawrence Barker
okay.
at Cranbrook.
Uh-huh.
And he agreed to give me an MFA for working with them for 2 years. And it was just, finally, everything is coming together.
Right.
It was just phenomenal. You know, I drove out from California and I went to the farmhouse. Nobody was in the mill that they built with Peggy and Kit. And I went in the farmhouse and his grandmother was in there. And I thought, oh my gosh, is this what paper making does to you? She was like 9 or something. But anyway, we worked so hard.
You were there for 2 years. Tell me a little about, I don't even know how long they had apprentices. They had many 2-year apprentices, right? Were you one of the first, or where did you fall in that? And were you the only one at the time, or were there more of you there?
Katie McGregor was with me.
Okay.
We lived together in Bernie. Bernie Vanzani was
okay.
there. And Barb Tettenbaum was the printer in residence. And
okay.
So we're all very close.
Yeah.
That was there at the same time.
Okay.
Howie was downtown in Brookston where he was producing the beaters and the presses. And he had an assistant, Sue Totten. We're also very close with her. So my first order was to make $11,000 worth of paper for Robert Rauschenberg. And it was real thick. We couldn't cooch it when we first formed it. We had to put another mold upside down and squeeze excess water out
wow.
before we could lift it, drain it, and cooch it, or it would have just gone, you know, on the felt. It was really heavy. I think it was 22 by 30 and heavy.
Ugh.
We looked like incredible Hulks. You know, we did production every single day.
Oh, yeah.
Katie and I had to get there early and start the beater, and Howie would make us a fried egg and an English muffin, and then we'd start our day. We made paper for Robert Rauschenberg, Jim Dine, Fritz Schulder, Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol wanted an exaggerated decal, and Bernie was so wonderful really good at figuring out problem solving, and I became a really good problem solver too. So how do you do an exaggerated decal? Well, simple, you put foam in underneath the decal to make it raise, and you let a little bit of pulp drain out, so the decal acts as a loose fence, and and you can pick excess off where you want to. And that was for his Portraits of Famous People. It was so exciting. And then Lee Bontecue, Wesley Tanner and Andrew Hoyam, Fine Book Printers, Joe Good, Linnea Gentry, Claire Van Vliet, Harmony Hammond, who lives here in Galisteo now. So it was just really, really exciting.
Did many of those artists come to Twin Rocker? Because Twin Rocker's in Indiana, and a lot of these artists were living in New York, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and Andy Warhol just signed work. You know, he had
right
a factory. We had a lot of visiting artists, and lots of problem solving there too. It was just wonderful. And, you know, I love to cook, and I would often make dinners when we had visiting artists. And yeah, we lived in Brookston. And then that mill, you know, Kathy and Howie lived out there, out in the country out there. So,
right. You know, I've been to two places, but this was just a couple of years ago. So it went the to mill the was in town now,
the
I
mill,
guess.
It's
it
in
always
town
was
now.
In town. Okay.
It's in town now, but it was out in the country.
Okay. Got it.
And, Howie's sister lives in the farmhouse out there now.
Okay.
And the old mill is just, they're just going to let it fall down, basically.
I see.
They have the big new space. And
right.
Kathy and Howie are retired, and they hired a local person. So they had about apprentices. They only apprenticed 14 people.
Okay.
So, of course, Tim Barrett was before me. Susan Hostetler, I don't know if you've met her. Lee McDonald, you know, many, many before me.
Right.
Yeah. And then we were next, somewhere in there. We just had a big reunion 3 years ago, and they presented us with an honorary doctor of papermaking, doctor of hand papermaking science and arts, with all honors, rights, and privileges thereunto appertaining. And they have their seal with the wax seal with the
How wonderful.
Signed by Howard and Catherine Clark. I have it framed here in my office.
Right. So what did you do after Twin Rocker?
Well, the wonderful thing about Twin Rocker was we learned the business. We did pulp orders. We shipped pigment. We shipped supplies. And then we learned how to make really good paper. I remember the first time I formed a good sheet, and I was looking out on the soybean field, and it was just this zen moment. And I took that with me. Sorry, I get emotional. So I moved back to Kansas City. My mother had colon cancer, and I wanted to be close to her. And she had inherited the farmhouse on 40 acres from my aunt and uncle,
who
was the cartoonist for the Star. And so it was originally a log cabin built in 1836, and they gradually added on. And then they inherited it in about 1971. And so she was living out there. And so I moved into the house I grew up in Kansas City. It was in the inner city. It was on 12th and Hardesty. I was the fourth generation. So my great-grandfather from Germany lived there, my grandfather, my mother, and then I lived there. And so I had that, and I started Kansas City Paperworks. I started it in the basement. I had big garage doors I could open to let light in with big screens. My Hollander beater was there. And I started doing production paper. And people started calling me. I had Hallmark. They were the first people to call me. And they wanted me to work with 10 of their artists. I would be artistic director to develop a line of cards. And I called Howie, and I said, Howie, do you think they can reproduce it so close they'll run us out of business? And he said, oh, no. You know, just do it. And so I didn't know what to charge. So I called an artist who did freelance for them. He said, don't charge less than $100 an hour. And that was in 1982. And, you know, $800 a day was pretty good. So they called me back, and they asked if I would do it. And I said, yes. And they said, how much would you like to be paid? And I said, $800 a day. They didn't flinch. So they said,
And so you... I'm curious about what you said about them being able to replicate or whatever. Were you training them to then make their own paper? Or
no, No.
They were making something
they were making something in my studio that would be reproduced. And it ended up, they were basically pulp paintings.
Uh-huh.
And they ended up being, they made some kind of die cuts and they ended up looking like plasticized paper.
So they were printed. They took photos of these pulp paintings and printed them as a line of art.
And did a textural die cut and then printed, yes.
And that was a line of cards.
It was a line of cards. Uh-huh. It was very popular.
Oh.
So I thought, well, this isn't too bad.
Right.
My first job is technical director for Hallmark making $800 a day.
Yeah.
And then people started calling me. All these book artists found out about me and they wanted me to collaborate with them. And that was my favorite part, was collaborating with other artists. I worked with John Tallur and Linda Tallur. John was head of printmaking at KU, at the University of Kansas in Lawrence. Mm-hmm. And I did two books with Linda. Linda ended up getting a Fulbright to work with a master printer in Japan. And she now, not Japan, I'm sorry, Italy. And she now teaches printmaking at KU and also paper making. John Tallur passed away quite a few years ago. But I loved collaborating with them, where the shape of the paper worked with the content in the book. Or for John's book, it was big, big book. We did 20. Museum of Modern Art bought one and put it in their special library collections. And for his, it was Eurydice Unbound was the name of it. And we did stencil sprayed in papers and stencil sprayed covers. And stencil sprayed his initials, JT, on the back of it. And it was bright yellow, bright blue, bright white for him. And then Linda did, her first book was Callisto. And I made the paper shaped like leaves. And it was also stencil sprayed with green on top. So those were really fun collaborations. And then I had Jack from Landfall Press come and order some paper, and then I started teaching. I had taught a workshop with Bernie Vinzani when I was at Twin Rocker, and I thought, this is kind of fun. And so we had a program called Arts Partners through Young Audiences, and I applied, and they were really excited about me going into the schools, all levels. Sixth graders were the worst. They were bouncing off the wall. So I was like, how did I do that? You know, workshops all day with all these kids. And I helped my great uncle made a small little screw press for me with on wheels, aluminum for me to take around to schools. I loaded pulp. I started selling pulp orders like we did at Home Rocker. And, I did workshops in 40 schools, 40 in Kansas City. And so I got to know all the art teachers. It was wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I had a student come up to me at an opening in Kansas City years later, and she said, I majored in papermaking at KU. And she was in a sixth grade workshop.
Yeah. Oh.
So, you know, so rewarding.
Mm-hmm.
And, then I started teaching at the Kansas City Art Institute, and I had gotten my BFA there, so I felt like I'd come full circle.
Mm-hmm.
And I taught there from 85 to 90, and I worked with Jane Lackey and Jason Pollan in the fiber department. I also worked for Continuing Ed. And the first semester, Young Audiences and Arts Partners paid half of my salary to go in and tailor make a program for each department. So I worked with fiber students, I worked with painting students, with printmaking students. So I really got to know all of the instructors there.
Right.
And then I started teaching there. And then they didn't have a tenure track position.
Mm.
So I started looking at alternative places to teach. And I got a tenure track position at another college in Kansas City called Maplewoods College.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in 1990. I started adjunct. In 93, I got the tenure track position. 92, I was burglarized at my studio at my house in the inner city. They stole my gram scales for wing ties. You know, crack houses were starting to go in. My mom said, we're just going to build. We're going to build you a house and studio onto this part of the house. So I had fabulous architects, you know, that it was like a psychology class with them. What's your sense of community? What's your sense of being home? And so they custom built, well, David Haggard was my builder. We became dear friends. He and his wife had graduated from the Art Institute in painting. And so it was just gorgeous. It was added on to my mom's part by a screened-in porch. And it had 40 feet of windows with north light overlooking the pond in the woods. And the bedroom was on the third floor. I always said I could never get back far enough for my work. And so I could go there and look down three stories onto my work. It was just beautiful. And,
yeah. There's a nice shot on your website of looking
and
down.
Also in, also in my book.
Oh, yeah.
In my book, Black and White. So I became chair of the art department at Maplewoods, and I started a fiber program immediately. And it was wonderful.
So you brought paper making in there. Did you have to bring equipment? And
I didn't. I made, so I ended up building. So Maplewoods was 1 mile from my house in my studio in Kansas City. And I taught 4 days a week. So I had 3 days to continue my work because I continued showing, you know, I had been in 7 museum shows. And well, there'll be 8 next year. There'll be another one next year. So I had time, and I was finished teaching by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So that just worked out really well. But I taught surface design. I taught shibori. I taught felt making with flax and wool, mono printing with dyes, and then paper making. And I made the pulp and brought it in. But I also taught Japanese paper making. I'd have the students come to my studio for that so they could hand beat the gozo and not disrupt the rest of the humanity. So that was really fun.
Yeah, wonderful.
Hey, listeners, let's take a little break here, and I want to make sure that you know about my how-to books about papermaking and paper crafts. My latest book is called The Art of Papercraft, and it offers a rich variety of projects that will delight crafters, artists, and designers alike, including paper votive lights, pop-up cards, folded paper gift boxes and envelopes, woven paper wall hangings, miniature one-sheet books, and much more. I also have 2 popular books about papermaking: Papermaking with Garden Plants and Common Weeds, and The Papermaker's Companion. All 3 books are available on Kindle. Now back to our conversation.
Let's talk about your work then, because you just mentioned it. And were you making art all along, even at Twin Rocker? And I know you got really interested in the Mexican papermaking traditions.
Okay, let's talk about all that.
Yeah.
I got interested in transparency because of Douglas Howell. He was experimenting with what happened if you embedded fibers that were of a different fiber type than the pulp that you were embedding that in. It would cause this interesting shrinkage, you know? Mm-hmm. And so ever since then, I mean, some of his work looked like animal skins, really, overbeaten. And really became interested in that. So I had to work on a master's thesis. So I was doing my own work while I was apprenticing at Twin Rocker. And I was able to go to the Institute of Paper Chemistry when it was in Appleton, Wisconsin, and look at old patents, rooms filled with patents on how they transparentize paper.
Oh, wow.
And I wrote a master's thesis on that. And so
Oh.
I did a lot of overbeaten fiber and made a lot of transparent paper. There were other processes they used, including albumen to transparentize paper, of course, wax, you know, many other things.
Right.
Really great learning experience.
So that would have been all in the industry. You were looking at patents for industrial paper,
industrial paper.
Like what kind of translucent papers? Like the vellum, non-animal skin vellum. Yeah.
Right. Wax paper.
Wax paper, right. Yeah.
Tracing
paper.
Oh,
how cool.
So then I kept getting sabbaticals from my school, and fiance was killed in a carjacking in New Mexico in Albuquerque in 1993. He had come out, he had been my best friend for 25 years, and he had come out to Kansas City. I met him in Kansas City when I was in college, so we knew each other for years. And I had made paper for their wedding announcement when he got married. And he was divorced then when he came out, and I was kind of finished with a relationship, and we went on a 17-day hiking and camping trip together all through Colorado and New Mexico, and we decided to be together. And I had just started building my studio. Oh yeah, he came out for that, and actually it was finished. I had an open studio, and then he was killed that same year. It was my first semester as chair of the art department, and he was shot in the head by two kids on crack in Albuquerque. So I feel like I've come full circle, because I couldn't come back for 9 years. And he really had a love for Latin America and Mexico. So I realized my college slide library had nothing on pre-Columbian art or anything from Latin America. Helen Turner, who was chair before me, really focused on India, East India, and Chinese, and had tons of slides on that and taught an art history class on that. She really wanted me to do that, but I was more interested in pre-Columbian. So
was this at the Art Institute or MCC?
No, that was at Maplewood.
Maplewood, okay.
They were very wonderful, mostly female administration, lots of great faculty, female faculty. I had students get full scholarships to the Art Institute after transferring. So I got a grant to go to Mexico in 1997 to document the Otomi making bark paper. And that opened up a whole world for me. And I wrote an article about them and commissioned them to make enough, what I called lace paper. I'll explain that. Enough lace paper to tip into my hand paper making article. So I started just loving giving back to the communities I was documenting. So this paper, they usually make a mate and they lay out the fiber in right angles. This time I saw some drawing on a big board and they weren't filling in the fibers. They were using a grid structure. This wasn't being sold yet. It was the first time I had seen it.
And can you back up and just describe how the traditional mate is made? And we'll put a picture. You sent me a nice picture.
Okay. Because I have one of him filling in, but I also have one of it, the lace paper drying on the board. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, normally they cook the fiber. They use hanote fiber and sometimes mulberry, but usually they cook it in wood ash, and then rinse it and peel it into smaller pieces and lay it out at a grid. And then fill in the negative spaces between the grid and use a lava stone beater and beat it into a solid form of a mate.
So this is pounded bark paper. There's no, mm-hmm. it's not traditional paper making. Just
no, no. So yeah. these are considered pre-papers.
Mm-hmm.
I made paper for, who was that who did the Strange Paper book?
Fred Siegenthaler.
Oh, yeah, I made papers for
okay.
him. One that was okra paper. I had a student at the Art Institute bring me a truckload of okra. That was the hardest paper I've ever made. It was real slimy, like okra.
Uh-huh.
It was, you
know, yeah. When
I pulled it out of the vat, it was just dripping slime. But it was beautiful paper. It looked like animal skin.
Ah.
So I sort of finally achieved that, you know.
Right.
So that was just an incredible experience. I traveled with a friend, and we stayed in Pahuatlan, and we hired a driver to take us about 30 minutes to San Pablito. And when we pulled up at the church and got out, all we heard was beating. The whole village was beating, and all my hair stood up all over my body.
Wow.
So then I traveled, I got another grant to go to Guatemala. And that's when I met my friend Lydia in Guatemala. I took a backstrap weaving workshop with her there. And now we've been friends for 25 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I just got her into the folk art market. And she's coming in 11 days to be with me.
Mm-hmm.
I have a lot of weavings in the folk art market. So then in 2000, I got a National Endowment grant, National Endowment for Humanities. It was called Maya World, and they gave me full funding for 6 weeks with 14 Mayan scholars in Mexico, Guatemala, and Honduras. We went to Copan with Michael Coe from Yale, and it was just an incredible experience. And I documented all the archaeological sites, all the Mayan sites. Sorry.
Puppy's having fun. Yeah.
Uh-huh. No, this is the other one. Then I became just interested in maybe developing a pre-Columbian art history course, which uh-huh. I ended up doing. So, you know, one thing just led to another. It was like John was interested in Mexico, so I became interested, and then all these doors opened for me, and they fed my soul, and I was able to give back to these communities. So then I got a grant to document the Lacandon Maya in Chiapas making bark paper. And well, in San Pablito, their tradition is closely related to Aztec. And then the Lacandon are the last of the Maya making Ho'un paper. And I went with Dr. John McGee. He's an anthropologist who's worked with them years and years and years. And he speaks Yucatec Maya.
Mm.
I wrote to him, and he thought I had really good intentions. I told him I would like to document them and collect for museum bark cloth tunics, bark cloth beaters, bark cloth. And so he agreed to take me with some graduate students, and he translated for me. And I was able to document a ceremony in the God House where they had rattles hanging in the rafters with bark cloth streamers. I was able to buy bark cloth headbands, and then I was able to document making the bark cloth. I was able to help make it. We went into the jungle and they cut down a ficus tree with a machete, mm-hmm. and then they stripped off the outer bark and took the inner bark. And it took 6 hours to beat it. No water was added. It was beaten on a tamarind log with a wooden beater that had slots in it. And it was a lot of work, you know, sitting on the ground on banana leaves, pounding this. The Maya used the circle to represent bloodletting. They used to bloodlet. They used to pierce their ear, their penis onto bark paper. And when you look at old stele, you can see a Mayan holding a brazier that has bark paper streamers with circles of blood on it. And they burned it because they believed the gods preferred smoke for the blessings to be received. So that's what got me using the circle, actually.
Okay, I want to ask you a couple of questions.
Okay.
What is the distinguishing feature of Ho'un paper?
Ho'un is real rough texture. It's not dry. It's dried on a clothesline.
Okay.
Monte's dried on boards, so
okay.
It's, you know, really smooth, especially on the board side, very, very smooth. So that's the difference.
And the Ho'un is made by the Mayans? And
the
then
Lacandon Maya.
Lacandon Mayans and the Amate?
Is closer related to the Aztec papermaking.
Okay. Okay, and now you've mentioned collecting, and I know you've written, you have a couple of links for me about articles you've written that I'll put in the show notes. What about all these artifacts, and is there an archive somewhere of all of this? Do you still own that, or?
I still own it, but I'm so excited that Jill Powers came here and with a curator from Santa Fe, and they selected 19 of my artifacts to go into. They're doing a bark paper show at the Robert C. Williams Museum of Papermaking.
Okay.
And it's also going to travel to the North American Papermaking Conference. So that's very exciting. So,
oh, good.
And I have four of the Otomi books. When we pulled up into town, someone got off a bus and had Otomi books, which aren't really produced, I don't think, anymore. So I have four of those. I have Mbuti bark cloth. I have a huge piece of Ho'un from the Lacandon. I have a bark cloth tunic with circles on it that they painted with a natto red.
Yeah.
They've faded now, but a lot of artifacts and beaters. I have a pre-Columbian beater and also the beater from the Lacandon. So that's very exciting.
Wow. And did you develop this course that you mentioned earlier?
So yeah. Then I got another grant from my college. These were called action plan grants to travel to Peru for a month. And I documented 24 archaeological sites there. It was just amazing. Following that, I got a grant to Ecuador, and I was in Ecuador a month. I spent 2 weeks in the Amazon and living in thatched roofed huts with the Amazonian Ecuadorians. And then I was up in the Andes, and I helped harvest cochineal for dyeing and all that kind of stuff. So I did develop this course. I did. Because I had so many slides of all these sites. And so during my second sabbatical, I really dove into that. Started doing research on all these sites. You should see my library. I have so many books on the Maya and Peru and all the sites in Ecuador. So,
right. Wow.
I don't know where that collection is going to go. I have to figure it out. It has to go somewhere good. I've been doing research on who has pre-Columbian art history right now in the United States. So that's where the circle came in with my work. So I after observing the Otomi making this what I call lace paper, I had cooked some kozo. Tim Barrett came out to Twin Rocker, and you know, we did a workshop with him, and then I brought him to do a workshop at the Kansas City Art Institute. So I know Tim really well and consider him a good friend. And I had this kozo and I hadn't beaten it. So I thought, I had been working in a real linear manner using plaster gauze and wringing out water. Soaking it, wringing out water, and then drawing with it and letting it dry and then braying color on it. And so I just took that into using kozo and started drawing with the kozo. And
right.
I bought a $10 lava stone beater from the Otome, and I use that tool every day in my studio. So that's how I started doing my technique. I had a show, and I sold the first 4x8 foot big Pozo drawing I did, and I thought, okay, this is going well. I think I'll keep doing this. So I did, and then I started doing black and white. You asked about that, and so John Livingston really instilled in us the notion of multiple element construction, and I still use that today. So that's what my work is about. It's about repetition. It's about multiples. And I didn't want color to be a distraction. I wanted to focus on the form. And light and shadow is really important to me. Mm-hmm. It makes the work seem more dimensional and more sort of dramatic. And I want to read a quote that's in my book from Louise Nevelson. She said, they used to say black and white were not colors, but I'm twisting that to tell you that for me, it is the total of color. It means totality. It means contains all. And I thought that was just a really great quote from her. So
Right. And we'll mention this book, or let's just mention it now. So this is a catalog that you published called Black and White.
Yes.
And I'll put a link to, it's a Blurb publication you can find online. Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you. So the circle started coming into my work, and the circle also represented the ball game, the Maya hero twins in the Popol Vuh, the jaguar spots, the continuation of life, of course, and then blood. So I started working with the circle a lot, and I can't seem to shake it. I'm doing some other work now where I'm kind of stretching and pulling the Kozo apart and building layers that way. But I use repetition. I'm using cable ties a lot. I want the work to be beautiful, but yet a little bit foreboding.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people get that. And the installation I did that was here, it was called Fibrous Metaphor. It's a big installation that hangs from the ceiling. It's about 8 feet by 8 feet, and the pieces move. And again, all my work usually hangs out from the wall or from the ceiling, and it creates beautiful shadows. So the show was at Gallery Fritz, Fibrous Metaphor, and I had just finished the shedding piece. And shedding was really about what I've been through. My mother died. I retired early. I retired young from Maple Woods, and I went through a big breakup from a 9-year relationship. I had been divorced, and I'd been coming to Santa Fe since 82. I came out to visit John in Albuquerque once, and I said, hey, I'm moving to Santa Fe. And I found this great house, and I have a studio in my house, and it overlooks the mountains. It's passive solar. I have 64 running feet of floor-to-ceiling windows. It's just...
And now what year was that you moved to Santa Fe?
7 years ago.
Seven years, okay.
2016, yeah, okay. And I retired in 2012.
Okay. And did you move papermaking equipment, or are you just pounding now?
I sold it to the Kansas City Art Institute. Okay. So they have my beater I had taught there that says "Made for Jenny Frederick" by Howard Klein, 1979. And I sold my molds.
Yeah.
I regret that. And my press, 22 by 30, it would accommodate a 20-ton press that Howie made for me. But I'm just using Kozo, and I use silk waste also. And it's much easier on my back, you know.
Oh, yeah, I can see that day coming for me. Yeah.
So yeah. I can even sit down and do it.
Right.
So, and I found it with my lava stone beater. So my neighbors hear me pounding over here.
I was really intrigued by your piece called Shedding. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? Describe it, and we'll put a picture in the show notes.
That's the one I was just talking about.
Yeah.
That has the ceiling, 8 feet by 8 feet. So what I did, I just started drawing with the Koza. What I do is I draw with it on plastic. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I use methyl cellulose or something to harden it just a little bit.
Uh-huh.
Then I put another piece of plastic on top. I'm telling my secrets. And then I beat it with my lava stone beater.
Okay, so you're creating it flat.
Creating it flat, mm-hmm. and then I conform it. And okay. that also had some transparent paper added. It had some matte medium. It had some wax. I was working with mm-hmm. encaustic wax with my work for a while. Mm-hmm. I just sold all my encaustic equipment. I was doing monotypes and mm-hmm. sometimes adding it to my Koza pieces. And I just, I sold it to a friend who lives 1.4 miles from me. So if I ever want to use it, I know where to go.
mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was a metaphor for all the changes and things I went through up to my move to Santa Fe. But it's probably one of my favorite pieces I've ever done.
Yeah, and I could see reading, the viewer reading a lot into that. It's almost like you can get a sense of the body in these forms, mm-hmm. or maybe it's something from nature. Mm-hmm. It's, mm-hmm. yeah. Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful piece. And I like what you're saying about using the shadows and
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. yeah. So I'm sorry, you were just about to say something.
Oh, I have some great shows coming up. I'm very excited about. I'm distracted right now because I have a puppy and Lydia's coming. She shipped all of her textiles she's a backstrap weaver. She got full funding to come out.
And she's from South America?
She's from San Antonio Aguascalientes in Guatemala.
Guatemala, okay.
20 minutes from Antigua.
Okay.
I've been there 25 years, and I led a tour there last year. And I'm leading a tour there in February, and we're taking cooking classes with Lydia. Tamales wrapped in banana leaves and pepian and all kinds of things. We're going to Lake Atitlan. I'm going to pitch this trip if anybody listening is interested.
Yeah.
Just look me up online, jennyfrederick.studio. And so I went to Kansas City. I try to go every year because I have hundreds of artist friends there.
Sure.
And I have someone I call my adopted daughter, Jill. She took every class I ever taught. And she's going to inherit my house and anything, if I have anything left. And so I always have to go see her. And she's been out here a couple times since I moved here. But she has two kids, so she's really, really busy and works full time. I'm so proud of her. And so I went back last fall and I took a jump drive with my new work on it and went to a couple of my favorite galleries in the Crossroads District, a huge art scene in Kansas City mm-hmm. because of the Kansas City Art Institute.
Sure.
And both galleries want to show my work. So I got two solo shows
in
Kansas City that are coming up. I have one in January. Bad time to travel across Kansas with your work, but that's what I have to do. And then a big show at Lidi Volkas Gallery on 2026, and then the bar cloth show, and then it's traveling again.
Right. Now, will you create new work and a combination of older or all new? Or
I'm creating new, but some older, and I had produced some really nice big pieces I had curated a 4-person show at Gallery Fritz here in Santa Fe with a wonderful sculptor from here, Paula Castillo. Her work is a lot about multiple. She's a welder and Hispanic. She lives out in Belen with her husband, and she used to be up in Cordova, and her husband used to be a wood carver, but now they both teach, or he works for a university I think either in Belen or a college in Albuquerque. But and with Jane Lackey, Jane and I taught at the Art Institute, and she and her husband live here now, okay, just down the road from me, and then an artist from New York and myself. So our show was supposed to open in July 2020, and Jane and I had a meeting there in March. I think it was March 20th, and I knocked, I pulled on the front door, and it was locked.
Right.
And I knocked, and somebody came to the door, and I said, "We have a meeting with Justin, the director." And he said, "We're closed." And I said, "What's going on?" And so Justin was just leaving out the back door, and he came up, and he said, "I don't know." He said, "Deborah just left crying, but everything was closed down, and they never reopened." So I didn't show. So I have a lot of large work that I'm going to show in the big gallery in 2026.
Okay.
So I'm the first show in 2024 is a smaller venue, so I'm going to I'm doing smaller pieces for that.
Great, great. And you had some recommendations. So we mentioned your catalog, Black and White. And I follow Brown Grotta Gallery, but you recommended the catalogs from them.
Oh, they have wonderful catalogs.
Talk about them, because you must know them from a long time ago. They've been around.
I know they have.
Yeah.
I thought about sending work to them, but I'm so busy right now. There's no way, you know. But they just have great artists.
A lot of fiber artists.
A lot of
sculpture.
Fiber.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And then I talked about my favorite artists. Ritzy Jacobi from Romania was always one of my favorite artists. She passed away not long ago, but I contacted her. I saw a show at the Contemporary in Chicago. I went up with Barb Tettenbaum when we were at Twin Rocker, and she had a solo show that just knocked my socks off. I cried. Mm. I wanted to stay in that gallery all night. It was just so phenomenal. And so I contacted her and asked, I said, I'm a paper maker. I'm working at Twin Rocker. She was working with paper at the time, building these great sculptures. I said, would you be interested in trading some of our paper? I'm working on transparency, because she was using transparent paper for one of her small sculptures. And she said, yes, but she wanted so much paper in return. I couldn't do it.
Oh.
I couldn't do it. But, and then Joan Livingston was a big influence, of course. And she ended up teaching at the Chicago Art Institute. And that's when she came in.
Is she still there? Has she retired?
I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
She was associate dean or dean, acting dean for a while. Interim dean, that's what I'm trying to say. And then lots of other influences, really. Magdalena Abakanowicz, you know, all the greats.
You had another book I wanted to bring up, The Art of Jiumqi by Jiang Cheng, because Jiumqi is a felting fiber paper technique from Korea. Mm-hmm. Have you used that technique in your work, or you just are fond of it?
I'm fond of it, and I would really like to take a workshop with her. Her workshops at, for example, Aramont, they fill so fast.
Right.
They're expensive. I thought it'd be really interesting to combine that with the way I work.
And mm-hmm.
I think it would be wonderful. So I'm still going to pursue that in the future. She doesn't do any workshops close to me. It seems like they're either in California or Florida, you know, they're pretty far away. But yeah, I love her work. We were in a show together. We were in a show together.
Yeah, I met her. She came to the Oregon College of Art and Craft when I was in Oregon, and I took a workshop with her. The department head knew her and brought her out. So,
oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah, that was really
neat. Now they closed. Yeah, I had a big, some big pieces, installation at the gallery there. I think it was called the Hoffman. Is that right?
I can't remember. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Barb came out to visit me last Christmas and stayed.
Right. Barb Tettenbaum. Yeah, wonderful. All right, Jenny. Well, it's super fun to catch up with you and hear about your life in paper and good luck with all of those exhibitions coming up. And you mentioned it, but tell us your website again where we can find you.
JennyFrederick.studio. And I'm also on Instagram. And I think that's Jenny.Frederick.studio.
And Jenny is J-E-N-N-I-E.
So great to see you.
Okay.
I have extra guest rooms. Come see me sometime.
Okay, will do. Okay, thanks, Jenny.
Bye.
Hey, paper friends. Did you know that I write a weekly blog called The Sunday Paper, featuring stories of people doing exciting, innovative, and beautiful things with paper? Sign up at HelenHebertStudio.com/blog. I'm also creating a lot of content over here, and the best way to stay up to date is to join my newsletter list to learn about free tutorials, online classes, workshops, and the annual Redcliffe Paper Retreat, which takes place right here at Helen Hebert's studio. You can find out more at HelenHebertStudio.com. This wraps up our episode, and if you enjoyed the show, I'd appreciate it if you could leave a review over on iTunes. This helps others find out about the podcast. Special thanks to Gary A. Hansen for the sound editing and Peter Thomas for the music. Visit HelenHebertStudio.com and click on podcast, where you can find out more about these guys, subscribe to this series via iTunes, and listen to other episodes and access all of the archived shows. Talk to you soon.
There's a reason besides the season.